Every step of your journey, from student activist to family court judge, you have had to confront and overcome stereotypes and obstacles. It wasn't easy, but you did so gladly and with determination because those for whom you were fighting did not have a voice of their own. You are listening to 2233, a podcast of exchange stories.
I went to the Supreme Court. I queued up at 6:30 in the morning, hoping I could get into the session hall and watch an oral argument. Unfortunately, I wasn't early enough. Only the first 50 people made it inside the session hall. But I finally made it inside at 10:15 in the morning, okay, for a 3-minute observation. And there she was. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the icon. And I was breathing the same air that she's breathing. Asking me, do I feel optimistic about the future? I should be, because at the time when RBG became a lawyer, the environment wasn't as embracing and inclusive of women as it is now. And that's also the same in the Philippines. So, for all I know, the RBG in the Philippines might already be appearing in my court.
This week, an activist goes to law school, blazing a path for women and running a tight courtroom ship. Join us on our journey from the Philippines to Minnesota, searching for justice for the most vulnerable among us. It's 2233.
We report what happens in the United States, warts and all.
These exchanges shaped who I am.
When you get to know these people, they're not quite like you. You read about them. They are people very much like ourselves. And
oh, that's what we call cultural exchange. Ooh, yes.
I am Ami A. Avellano. I'm a family court judge in the Philippines. I was first here in 2008 as a Hubert H. Humphrey Fellow. And I was posted at the University of Minnesota Law School, where I studied trafficking in persons, policy, and prevention. I came from a family where the parents are both government officials. And my parents always told us to study very well because the only thing that they could give us as inheritance is our education. Really thought that I would become a lawyer because I've always been an activist. That was the background I was coming from. I grew up during the time when the former dictator, Ferdinand E. Marcos, was ousted and President Corazon Aquino came into power after the EDSA Revolution. Okay, we're enjoying this democracy, and yet, do we really understand the things that people fought for so that we could enjoy it? You know, as an activist, you want to go out to the street, organize people. But my parents did not want that for me, because they're government officials, okay? And they thought, come on, Ami, you are enjoying this education because the government is supporting us, supporting your education. And I said, but tatay and nanay, that's daddy and mommy, okay? But tatay and nanay, you are earning, okay? Because you are serving the government. You're public servants. You're earning every cent that the government is paying you. It's not as if we owe the government. I wanted to continue with my mobilizing work. And the only way I could do that was to agree to go to law school. So I ended up in law school, not really thinking that I would become a lawyer. But eventually I made it to fourth year and made it to the bar exams. And there was I, already a lawyer. And I had to do something and I had to choose what kind of field I wanted to be in. I came from a generation of LA Law and Ally McBeal, and I thought I would die arguing my last case in court. That was the kind of lawyer I wanted to be and to remain, as a litigator, not thinking that I would become a judge one day or a family court judge. I work in a law firm as a legal researcher, and the senior partner was sending me to court to argue cases. So I was writing briefs, I was researching briefs for him that he was signing. Those briefs were related to cases of paying clients. And then one day, there was this father and daughter who walked into the office and sought pro bono representation. The daughter was raped by a neighbor, but the law office did not want to accept the case because they would be non-paying clients. And I talked to the law partner, please accept this case. I will do everything. I'll research all the pleadings. I will write the pleadings for you. Just accept the case. But I think not all law offices would want to run an office that way. So they went home very frustrated because their request for legal representation was not accepted. And it was then when I said, when I become a lawyer, I will help people like her. When I became a lawyer, it was a medium-sized law firm in the business district. I was the only female lawyer hired by that law firm. And the other female lawyer was the daughter of the managing partner. All the rest were male lawyers. But you see, when you are in a medium-sized law firm, you couldn't do much. They would dictate on you. They would send you to court to ask for postponements. And I did not want to be that kind of lawyer. So I transferred to a very small-sized law firm. And still the same. The law partner sent me to court, sent me to the office of the prosecutor, okay, telling me, oh, when you go there, you wear miniskirts. So I realized whether you are in a medium-sized firm or a small-sized firm, you really cannot choose the types of cases that you would be handling. So I decided to volunteer in an NGO. It's called Children's Legal Bureau. Until now, it's still existing. They are representing children who are abused, sexually abused, neglected, trafficked children. And that was when I realized I found my niche. I want to be a children's and human rights lawyer. When I was starting my legal career, there weren't many women inside the courtroom. In fact, one day I saw myself appearing in this court where the judge was presiding over his sala and he was not wearing the judicial robe. He was smoking. There were four other male lawyers inside the courtroom and all of them were smoking. I was the lone female lawyer in that courtroom and the judge jokingly said, "Iha, okay, what are you doing here? Did your mom send you to buy vinegar and you found yourself inside the courtroom? Are you sure you really passed the bar examinations? Where is your admission to the bar certificate?" That was the environment when I commenced my legal practice. But now, as a family court judge, okay, I'm seeing an equal balance of men and women lawyers inside the courtroom. And of course, I would not subject anyone to that kind of treatment. Whenever a very young lawyer would appear in front of me, I would ask that lawyer, what kind of lawyer do you want to be? Do you know how important it is to become a lawyer in this country? That you could actually use your license to protect the rule of law. Do not just be a lawyer for self-interest, to advance your career. It's good to earn money, but it's equally good or even more important and significant to help people so that they could protect their rights or assert their rights in court. From Children's Legal Bureau, I transitioned to another NGO. This time it's called Women's Legal Bureau. I started representing children in court and then I transitioned to representing victims of domestic violence in court. Then I returned to prosecution of child abuse cases with Child Justice League. Being inside the courtroom was not enough for me. I knew that I had to go out and teach people how they could better protect the children. How they could teach children, okay, to assert their rights, not just as children, but even as human beings. So I joined the Child Protection Unit at the Philippine General Hospital. And that was where I was able to work with a multidisciplinary team composed of doctors, child psychologists, child psychiatrists, social workers, police officers who are investigating child abuse cases. And from them, I learned how to render holistic case management and treatment to all these victims of child abuse cases. Then we did not have much venue to discuss and learn much about trafficking in persons. Okay? And we had a very new law back then. The National Law on Trafficking in Persons was passed in 2003. And I did my fellowship in 2008. So it was a five-year-old law. So we did not know how to effectively investigate trafficking cases. We did not know how to effectively present cases in court so that the traffickers could be pinned down and convicted. And I thought this would be an opportunity for me to know more about the subject so that when I could return, I could help improve the investigation, the prosecution side of this issue. I did a professional affiliation at Corner House. It's the best facility here in the United States on doing forensic interview of victims. And I thought this is something I could replicate in the Philippines. Most of the time, victims disappear in the middle of trial. So when you do not have the victim anymore, it would be extremely difficult to prove the case. And I thought if we could just preserve on video the testimony of the traffic victims, then this can be presented in court after properly authenticating. And this could help pin down the accused and still secure conviction. So that's what I did. like the collaboration of multidisciplinary team. When they investigate the crime, the prosecutor, the police officer, and the mental health professionals are there. Often, it's the prosecutor and the police investigator with the social worker conducting the interview. That, to me, is a best practice that should be replicated. Before I left for the United States, we were already doing that. But when I returned to the Philippines, I was able to develop a manual on how to conduct forensic videotape interview of trafficked minors. The interview is either done by a medical doctor who doesn't have any background in the law, okay, or a police officer with a social worker recording. Minnesota Supreme Court. And there I met Justice Paul Anderson. And he taught us this very valuable lesson. He said, whenever you're invited, always show up because you'll never know what opportunity you might miss but not showing up. Eventually, he became my teacher in law school. There were many justices and judges that I met during my Humphrey year. But there was another member of the bench that left a significant mark on my life. And I'm talking about Judge Lloyd Zimmerman, a family court judge. I shadowed him, I went to his court, and I saw how he humanized the court environment. It was the first time that I actually saw a judge address a litigant in court and said, "Good morning, Mr. So-and-so. What can the court do for you today?" Watching Judge Lloyd Zimmerman, I thought I could be a family court judge just like him and help humanize the court process. Fortunately for me, I have a court docket of less than 150 cases. And in a family court environment, you cannot be hostile. You should be this face of compassion, voice of wisdom. But sometimes when you are in front of this feuding couple, okay, who could not see the bigger picture, which is the best interest of the child that they are fighting over, it's difficult to humanize the court process. You get so agitated and angry. Why are you so selfish? Why can't you see the child? Just being a Humphrey Fellow is already a source of pride for somebody coming from a family where my father doesn't even have a passport. Coming here to the United States was just a big deal. It was a source of pride. But seeing myself in the middle of all those Humphrey Fellows coming from all parts of the globe was a great source of joy and pride. My father never really saw me. Whenever I would do a presentation, a small part of me was hoping, I wish my father could see me giving this presentation in front of this huge crowd. My father has Parkinson's disease. So when I became a lawyer, he was still very active. Now that I am on the bench, he is wheelchair bound. And he never saw me inside the courtroom. He never watched me give a presentation. My mother visited me one time in court, and that was the only time she saw me in action. But both of them never had a chance to watch me give a presentation in front of a huge crowd. And whenever I had to do a presentation during the Humphrey Fellowship program, you know, I was wishing, I hope this could be recorded so I could show this to my parents so they could also be proud of what their daughter is doing here in the United States. You see, I was doing my Humphrey Fellowship when they called me and asked me to join the Child Protection Network on a full-time basis. And I said, in what capacity? They said, well, you would still do legal advising, but you would be doing also resource mobilization work. Okay, and what exactly would you want me to do? Help us raise funds so that we could establish more women and child protection units across the country. So that when a child is abused, there would be a health facility, okay, where he or she could access services ranging from medical treatment to assistance in filing a case in court, psychosocial intervention through the help of social workers and other mental health professionals. So when I joined the Child Protection Network, it had very small percentage of local funding. But when I joined them, okay, and I applied what I learned from the Humphrey Fellowship about networking, talking to people, raising funds and resources, we were able to increase funding from the local people. Okay, so now I think it's on a 50-50 percentage. Returned to the Philippines and joined the Child Protection Network. I was doing primarily fundraising, resource mobilization work. Litigation work took a back seat. For somebody who thrives being inside the courtroom, enjoying how it is to cross-examine a witness, I really miss the courtroom. And I thought, a part of me will always yearn for the courtroom. So that was when I decided I should already apply to the bench. And I decided to become a family court judge, just like Judge Lloyd Zimmerman. It was 8:15 in the morning. I was a very new judge then. It was my first hearing date. And I put on my robe and walked into the courtroom. And there I was, tiny judge, a new face in the community. I think they were curious about me. They knew I wasn't from the area. I came from Manila. do not need to announce anymore that session starts at 8:30. Now I don't need to remind lawyers that you should not come to court unprepared. Because when they come to court unprepared and ask for continuance with an excuse that, "I'm sorry, Your Honor, I was not able to prepare the judicial affidavit of the witness," they know that they will be humiliated. And I would tell them in open court, "Okay, I will entertain this continuance just once, but you have to pay the postponement fee. And you cannot charge this against your client because it is your fault why we are postponing the case. So why should your client suffer for not being prepared for today's hearing?" I just want them to be prepared. I do not want them to shortchange their clients. I want them to know the ins and outs of their cases. I do not want to have that feeling that, "Come on, I can do better than that. And I just read your case file yesterday." I do not want to say, let us switch places. Let me argue your case. Because that to me would be very, very embarrassing. You see, one day, I was conducting a training, okay, in a nearby city where my sala is located. And there is this female who approached me and said, "Good morning, Judge. My husband speaks highly of you." And I said, "Why? Was your husband a litigant in my court?" And he said, he was there in your court in a marriage nullity case." And I asked her, "So which wife are you, the first wife or the second wife?" And she said, no, Judge, I'm actually the wife of the lawyer who appeared before your court. And he said, he's always excited whenever he would appear before you. And he looks up to you with respect. He said he wants to be like you someday. So I'm thinking maybe I'm being effective as a family court judge, because I'm inspiring people. I do not know. Perhaps.
"2233 is produced by The Collaboratory, an initiative within the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, better known as ECA. My name's Christopher Wurst. I'm the director of The Collaboratory. 2233 is named for Title 22, Chapter 33 of the U.S. Code, the statute that created ECA. And our stories come from participants of U.S. government-funded international exchange programs. This week, Judge Amy Avellano discussed her road to becoming a judge and the inspiration she found as a Humphrey Fellow researching human trafficking at the University of Minnesota. Go Gophers! For more about Fulbright and other ECA exchange programs, check out eca.state.gov. We encourage you to subscribe to 2233 and leave us a nice review while you're at it. And we'd love to hear from you. You can write to us at ecacollaboratory@state.gov. That's ecacollaboratory@state.gov. Photos of each week's interviewee and complete episode transcripts can be found at our webpage at ecacollaboratory.gov/2233. And now you can check us out on Instagram at 2233stories. Special thanks to our team in the Collaboratory, including our virtual interns, Laurel Stickley, Cynthia Uba, and Kelly Zhang. And special thanks to Amy Avellano for her stories and her passion for equal justice. I did the interview and edited this segment. Featured music was Aruru, Asterisk, Tartaruga, and 13s, all by the Blue Dot Sessions. Morning Too Soon by Ketza, and Pretty Build by Poddington Bear. Music at the top of this episode was Sebastian by How the Night Came, and the end credit music is Two Pianos by Tagir Lius. Until next time.